The trumpet player almost sounds like a recitative, the part in the opera where they're just saying lines. He's telling a story of the quiet city. William Sullivan, the trumpet soloist with the Utah Symphony Orchestra and Maurice Abravanel. Aaron Copland's Quiet City.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn, and thank you for tuning in. Well, we've got the latest information available to you regarding the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra and their 2007-2008 season at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. First concert of the season kicks off Saturday, September 29th, with a combined chorus of Dearborn. What a wonderful opportunity to see and hear from so many wonderfully talented performers right here in our own backyard. And very special, this concert is dedicated to the memory of Mayor Michael A. Guido. It's going to be a grand opening night, and we'd love you to be there. For details and more information about the Dearborn Symphony, give them a call, 313-565-2424. That's 313-565-2424. Or check them out on the web, DearbornSymphony.org.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Space Week, the wrap-up. Saturday, September 22nd, we are very happy to be into the fall season. My name is Carrie Zaitz, and I'll be with you for the next hour talking about sky science, my favorite topic. I'm joined in the studio by my much-esteemed friend and board op today, Jay Kornick, and we're going to be talking about various subjects relating to space, sky, phenomenon, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun talking about things that you've always wondered about, at least I've wondered about, and have lots to say about, hopefully. The first thing I'd like to talk about is something I found in the news, which is pretty interesting, actually, especially for lots of folks in the Dearborn and Dearborn Heights area. It has to do with the first Muslim astronaut going up into space, into the space station. It's very exciting. But before I get into that story, I'd actually like to play a little clip for you of a column that I wrote. Some of you are familiar with my Night Sky column, published in a few different papers around town, Dearborn Heights Press and Guide. And this was published a long time ago, but it has to do with Arabic stars. So I would like to play for you a little clip about Arabic star names. I did a Google search for Arabic stars, and I landed at a belly dance site. Funny. I had just visited my dance teacher, Princess Madiha. She's a real princess, living here in the Detroit metropolitan area. Madiha's mother was of the Awabdi family, originally a royal family in Syria. When Madiha's grandfather, Prince Halil Awabdi, died in a power struggle in the late 1800s, the family lost all their power and wealth. Her mother later married into a farming family. Both she and Madiha are entitled to retain the title of princess in memory of their heritage. Princess Madiha is one of those special people who enrich your life in ways it takes years to fully appreciate. She not only taught me how to dance,
but how to express the beauty in a kind of music that was new to me. She always said she didn't have blood in her veins, she had music instead. She always tells her students that until the music and movements are part of our vocabulary, we'd always dance with a foreign accent. I had been researching Arabic star names. The majority of star names are of Arabic origin. This is a little-known fact, since it's assumed that the Greeks named everything in the sky. Greek civilization was intensely interested in constellations and myths. Most of the constellations familiar to us today are of Greek origin, but the Greeks weren't as interested in the individual stars. It was the Arabs, between perhaps the 6th through the 12th centuries, that cataloged and named many stars. They used the stars for timekeeping, so they needed to know when individual stars rose and set. Western pronunciation has mutilated some of the names. Ibtel Jauza is the origin of the name Betelgeuse. Its meaning is clearer than its pronunciation. It means the armpit of the central one. Betelgeuse marks the right armpit of Orion, the mighty hunter. His foot is marked by a star named Rigel. In Arabic, Arigel means the foot. The names are to the point. The names of the constellations and planets come from the language of the Romans, Latin. However, the Romans adopted and assimilated the vast pantheon of gods and goddesses, heroes and witches from Greek culture, which in turn had assimilated images and symbols from even older cultures. The ancient Sumerians and Babylonians were the first to write down their ideas, but I'm pretty sure that folks made up star pictures even before there was writing. Humans have a strong impulse to recognize patterns in things. The sky is a good example of this. I've always thought it interesting that someone looked up at the teardrop shape of the stars in the summer sky and decided that it looked like an eagle. Or that the teapot shape of Sagittarius reminded the ancients of a centaur, a creature half horse, half man. But we look at the constellations with a modern, foreign accent and are ignorant of the very heavy and important symbolism the constellations once carried to cultures who relied on the stars to tell them stories of life and of time. When you look up into the sky, you see the same star patterns that people have seen since there have been people. But the planets are always in motion. So look up tonight, and you can see the mighty Jupiter right before sunset over in the western sky.
And that's true. You can see Jupiter. I hope you have seen Jupiter in the sky. It's right in the southwestern sky right after sunset. Actually, it's up there before sunset, but it's a little bit easier to see it after the sun goes down. And back to our story, though, about astronaut. The headline is Astronaut to Grapple with Daily Prayer Ritual. And it says, how does an observant Muslim kneel to Mecca in zero gravity? I thought it was pretty interesting. I have a friend who writes for various places, and he was doing some inquiry as to what was the protocol for praying in space, Muslims having to pray five times a day facing Mecca. Now think about that, being in orbit and trying to face Mecca. So, don't forget, you're orbiting every 90 minutes. You're traveling at great speeds and flying around the entire Earth every hour and a half. So it does present a problem. So let me read a little bit of this article to you just to give you some food for thought. It's pretty interesting. This is from Russia, by the way, Star City, Russia. Among the things Malaysian first... he's from Malaysia, actually. Malaysia's first astronaut will be worrying about next month. How does an observant Muslim pray toward Mecca while soaring hundreds of miles above the Earth? This astronaut's name is Sheikh Muzaffar Sukhar. He's 35 years old. He's one of three people who'll blast off aboard the Russian-built Soyuz spacecraft next month en route to the International Space Station. Sukhar, along with Russian cosmonaut Yuri Malenchikov and U.S. astronaut Peggy Whitson, was officially approved for his mission Thursday by Russian Space Flight Commission. They blast off on October 10th, so... he's wondering, actually at a news conference, he was asked questions about what's he going to do in space, about some of his Muslim rituals. He said during his 10 days in space, he hoped to perform life science and other research, but he would not ignore the responsibilities of his faith while soaring about 220 miles up. He says, I do agree that I am a Muslim, I am Islamic, but my main priority is that of conducting experiments. As a Muslim, I do hope to do my responsibilities. I do hope to fast in space. Don't forget, we're in Ramadan right now for the Muslim community, meaning they do not eat from sunup to sundown. Another interesting question. You have a sunrise and a sunset every 90 minutes. Exactly, yeah. Jay's over there rolling his eyes. It's like, yeah, that's complicated. It's very complicated. Let's see. After months of discussion and two international conferences, the Islamic National Fatwa Council came up with the guidelines as to how Muslim astronauts should observe daily rituals. The rules were published in a booklet, so they've written it down. Observant Muslims are required to turn toward Mecca, located in Saudi Arabia, and kneel and pray 5 times a day. However, with a space station circling the Earth 16 times a day, washing one's face and hands and kneeling in zero gravity to pray, or even facing toward Mecca, makes fulfilling those religious obligations difficult. So they have decided that Muslim astronauts will not be required to kneel to pray if the absence of gravity makes it too hard. Well, we know that they have to do everything in zero gravity, including washing and going to the bathroom. And maybe we've heard stories about those vacuum-powered, incredibly expensive toilets they have above the International Space Station. So everything up there is difficult. It's worse than living in New York City. There's nothing that you can do that's not difficult, except for walking on the space station. Continuing on, facing Mecca while praying will be left to the best abilities of the astronaut, the council said. Wow, the best abilities. I guess I'm not sure what that means. I mean, I guess you'll get your bearings by looking down, but interesting. Adding to the difficulties is the fact that the launch coincides with the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, as we mentioned, when Muslims are expected to fast from dawn till dusk. But luckily, and this is true for certain situations on Earth, fasting can be postponed until returning to Earth. I think that would make things significantly more simple. Well, that's an interesting little story, maybe with some local interest for lots of our Muslim community, as well as all of us. I mean, when you think about it, those folks are up there all the time. There have been astronauts on the International Space Station since the year 2000. I know it sounds crazy, but yes, we've had that machine up there and people living in space continuously for the past 7 years. Now, you probably understand that it's not the same people living up there, that every 6 months or so they have to come down. We send new astronauts up. And we don't do it via our space shuttle. We do it via the Russian Soyuz spaceships, because our space fleet is grounded a little bit right now. Still not completely sure that they are safe to operate. So we are relying on Russian spaceships to get us up and down, to provide them with fresh fruit, vegetables, and all the supplies they need. Yes, those people are up there. They probably get ignored and not thought of by most of us for most of their time up there, but we do have people living in space continuously. I'd like to kind of move on to something a little bit more poetic. Since we're on the topic of Islamic science a little bit, I wrote a column a long time ago about one of my favorite pieces of literature. It's called The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And I'd like to interject that right now, just to get us thinking a little bit more about maybe some of the poetry of space. Jay, are you leaving me? Because I'm looking forward to you playing my track 11 right now, if you would. I guess I should have let my poor board op know what I was doing.
Ready?
Yes, I'm ready. Thank you.
A long time ago, there lived a poet-astronomer named Omar Khayyam. He was born in Persia in 1048. His list of accomplishments was long, since he was a scientist, astronomer, mathematician, philosopher, and poet. He made a new calendar that was better than the Julian and almost as good as the Gregorian calendar. He made contributions to algebra and astronomy, but he is famous for his poetry, especially the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. I wanted to share a few verses of this beautiful poem with you. Rubaiyat is a word that means quatrains, referring to the four-line verses of the poem. The Rubaiyat were most famously translated by a 19th-century scholar-poet named Edward Fitzgerald, and it's his version I'm quoting. You might be familiar with this one. A book of verses underneath the bough, a jug of wine, a loaf of bread, and thou. Beside me singing in the wilderness, oh, wilderness where paradise is now. How romantic. This is how the Rubaiyat begins. Wake, for the sun who scattered into flight the stars before him from the field of night, drives night along with them from heaven and strikes the sultan's turret with a shaft of light. What a beautiful image of the sunrise scattering the starlight away, and the first sunbeam striking the turret with its light. Here's my favorite. And that inverted bowl they call the sky, whereunder crawling cooped we live and die. Lift not to your hands to it for help, for it as impotently moves as you or I. Omar Khayyam seems to be reminding us not to wait for the stars for help. They just slowly roll by, winking and twinkling at us. When you are outside this week, you can imagine the stars winking at you, but the planets will not seem to wink at all. Bright Venus watches us unblinkingly from her perch in the early morning eastern sky. And Jupiter sinks low along the western horizon at night, right after sunset. The planets give us steady light because the twinkling starlight is caused by the movement of the Earth's atmosphere. It doesn't bother the strong light we get from our neighbors, Mars, Venus, and Jupiter. They are much closer to us than any star in the night sky, and therefore they give us much more light, though it is only reflected from the sun. I like to think of that when we look at the inverted bowl we call the sky. We can all be poet astronomers. All it takes is a little appreciation of the beauty, and with such a view of the planets and stars, it's easy.
And we're back live, and I have another call or a little article to read because it kind of ties into what we've been saying about the International Space Station, and this has extremely local interest. It seems that when astronauts up in the space station, they really look forward to their fresh fruits and vegetables, as you might imagine, living 6 months up in a fairly sterile environment above the Earth, no grass, no trees, no fresh air. They really look forward to that Soyuz craft coming with their new supplies. Well, the problem is that it's hard to get food up there, fresh food especially, without spoiling. So NASA helps wipe away worries about germs. Here's what they've done. Fresh fruits and vegetables have been in demand by orbiting astronauts since the early days of the space shuttle. But fresh produce can create a queasy bouquet in a closed space environment as it ages past its prime. NASA has helped develop a product that thoroughly cleanses fruits and vegetables being sent into space, helping to increase their shelf life. Meanwhile, this product is ripe for the picking for consumers on Earth. Now, get this. This is NASA teamed with Microsite Incorporation of Troy, Michigan, to develop a non-toxic, biodegradable, killing microbes, product to disinfect fresh fruit and vegetables for the space shuttle crews. The product is called ProSan. It's safe, stable, and biodegradable for use in space. Does that not sound sweet to you, Jane? Jay? My goodness. I mean, we've got this product developed by NASA, one of many, many products developed by NASA for space program, which seems like it's going to be awesome for use here on Earth.
Yummy.
Even better than Tang, and better for us, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Once dropped in water, the packet dissolves and creates a ready-to-use sanitizer. Wonderful. But I like these words, safe, stable, and biodegradable. So the sanitizer is also available on Earth to keep produce safe from harmful foodborne bacteria. So this actually comes from a website called spacetravel.com, and it's reports from NASA. So this comes from NASA, this information. And pretty cool, I think, that NASA working to keep their astronauts from smelling rotten bananas have actually helped us out here on Earth. Let's see. In addition to fruits and vegetables, the sanitizer can be used on countertops, cutting boards, dishes, utensils, forks, knives, and sinks. This makes it ideal for use in hospitals, nursing homes, daycare centers, dormitories, restaurants, and offices. And as an additional bonus, the sanitizer lacks volatile organic compounds, so it doesn't pollute the air in homes and kitchens. Since these same chemicals can be a major contributing factor to ozone pollution, NASA's solution for keeping veggies greener and cleaner may also be a green solution for the environment. Wonderful. Thank you, NASA, because just last night I was washing my grapes with a solution that you can get at a store, a grocery store, to try to get some of the pesticides and fingerprints, I suppose, off your grapes, because I was feeding them to my next-door neighbor who was pregnant, and I was concerned that perhaps she should not be ingesting some of those pesticides or anything else that's on the grapes.
Yes, I saw a definitive study. Thank you for allowing me to be here with you this morning, Carrie, just to...
Always my pleasure, Jay.
...delay different segments when they should go on time. But no, I heard a story on, of all things, our other great non-commercial educational station in Detroit, and that is WDET, that National Public Radio was reporting on a study. What is the best way to clean your vegetables and your fruits? Okay, and they found that the most effective way to remove all kinds of pesticide residues as well as bacteria, viruses, and get this one, it's not any commercially available product. It is simply a mixture of three parts water and one part white distilled vinegar.
We love vinegar.
You spray it on with a plant sprayer or something like that, and just rinse it off with tap water afterwards. You don't have to scrub it. They even tested scrubbers and everything, but just the vinegar itself, and it's so inexpensive, you know.
Certainly.
Although vinegar, I noticed I bought some sort of spray surface cleaner for my house, and I realized it's just vinegar and water in the bottle. But it is extremely effective. It is germicidal, and it removes all kinds of other residues. So, I mean, science marches on. You got to keep up, people. Like, you got to keep listening to Carrie now.
Yeah, definitely. But I know I listen to my grandmother and my mother, who take tablespoons of vinegar daily. Apple cider vinegar, of course. For health reasons, apparently, although I have gone to websites before researching the benefits of vinegar, and the list is very long of all the benefits of vinegar. Around the house, ingesting it, keeping critters away, etc. So it's one of those wonder fluids that we overlook. Although I do have three different kinds of vinegar in my refrigerator, I noticed yesterday as I was looking.
What kind of critters do you keep away with vinegar?
Oh, bugs, actually. Bugs don't...
Little critters.
Yeah, okay. On your counter. So cleaning with vinegar, that vinegar water solution seems to be beneficial in many ways.
Okay.
And non-toxic. We love that word, non-toxic, as we know that the toxicity in our houses are probably a lot higher than is healthy for us. Okay, well, speaking of living on the planet, I'd like to actually move into an area of talking about the solar system and planets. There's a lot of news going on. I really appreciated, Jay, listening to the journal last night, or I'm sorry, yesterday morning, and your little radio spot you played from the Planetary Society talking about Iapetus, a moon of Jupiter. And I might bring up Jupiter a few times because it is the most glorious planet you can see at night right now. Really, take a look at it. I've had somebody think that it was the International Space Station because it was so bright and noticeable. However, if you were actually seeing the International Space Station, which, by the way, you can see from time to time, but it would be moving fairly rapidly through the sky, probably at a pretty low angle. Jupiter, on the other hand, will be shining pretty steadily, very brightly in, again, the southwest horizon, following the sun down. The moon will also be out the next few nights, growing larger each night until we get up to, what's the date? September 27th, I think. I wrote it down. Wanted to make sure I didn't get it right or didn't get it wrong. Harvest moon this month, Jay, coming up on the 26th, Wednesday the 26th.
So what do we do?
What is a harvest moon? Well,
yes.
You can dance naked in the moonlight if you're so inclined, or you can just notice it and move on. However, a lot of people are kind of...
I mean, historically, people actually used it as a sign to actually harvest, right? Crops?
Not necessarily.
Just during harvest time,
I think,
it comes
I think
up.
This, I think the sign of harvesting is that your crops are done.
Yeah,
put a fork in
Thank goodness. We can rest now for the winter. Yeah.
I'm actually looking at my tomatoes in my backyard, and they are still green as grass right now. So I'm not sure if they're going to get in there ripening chemicals before the first hard frost. However, Harvest Moon, basically, many people think that it's up in the sky longer, but actually at this time of year, it's not. Yesterday was the equinox. I don't know if you celebrated that either, Jay, but equinox meaning the equal night, Latin for equinox, equal night, equal day, 12 hours of each. Sun rises due east, sets due west. That only happens two times a year, spring equinox and fall equinox. The harvest moon, therefore, is the full moon closest to the equinox, and that was yesterday. So this month we'll see our harvest moon. It will be a beautiful full moon, but it's not necessarily that it's up in the sky higher. It's not. It's basically that this time of year, when the sun is going down more rapidly, you notice the days are getting shorter, the full moon provided farmers with extra light so that they could get in their crops once they started harvesting. So it's called the harvest moon. It's kind of like an extra flashlight for the farmers to help them get our food in for us. Another thing you'll notice about the moon at this time of year, if you are a moon watcher, is that it seems to rise about the same time every night, and that's not necessarily the case most of the year. Actually, the moon rises on average about 50 minutes later. That's 50 minutes later every night as it's orbiting the Earth. But at this time of the year, it's a little complicated to get into, but the angle that its path makes with the horizon is actually quite quite a small angle, so you won't notice the change that much this time of year, which also provides more light at night with a pretty full moon. So that's the whole deal with the harvest moon. It's, you know, kind of a historical thing. Each full moon has its own name, but I think the harvest moon is sort of a romantic idea, especially this time of year when we're noticing the short days.
A lot of people like to appreciate, especially in Michigan, the four seasons, too. There's a psychological advantage to the cycle of the seasons. It seems like it's actually suggesting a new time of life, a new change. I know it's just sort of symbolic, but in a way, of course, when the weather changes, then you have to change your the whole manner of your lifestyle, too. And in many hundreds or thousands of years ago, it was much more a change than it is today. But I know there's some people last week that was even telling me that, oh, gee, I wish this summer would get over. I want fall.
Oh,
I said, it's just two days away. It's just a day. Technically.
And
it'll
here
still
in Michigan,
take...
we've already had those few cold days to remind us that the winter is coming. However, right now, we couldn't be happier with our beautiful weather. Our little bit of dog days of summer and a little bit of maybe Indian summer already, but it's a little bit early for that. But speaking of, you know, wonderful weather, I'd like to talk a little bit about Mars, believe it or not, because some of the news lately has to do with maybe finding water on Mars and maybe not finding water on Mars, a little bit of disappointment about what we thought might have been signs of recent water turning into something that maybe not so much. Mars has always fascinated us, of course, because of the possibility of more habitable conditions on Mars, a thicker atmosphere, perhaps liquid water, warmer because of that atmosphere. Mars is only a third of the size of the Earth, and that's one of the main problems with it. It's farther from the Sun than the Earth, of course, but that really isn't the influencing factor in Mars not having any signs of life. It's because it's so small, its gravity really couldn't hold its thick atmosphere too long. So without much of an atmosphere, without much of a greenhouse effect, dare I say those words, actually the greenhouse effect is crucial to life on Earth and would have been to Mars as well, holding in enough solar radiation to make the temperatures more reasonable for some sort of life. So it seems that the spaceships orbiting and on Mars right now have been scouring the surface for signs of life and had found, according to this article from September 21st out of Pasadena, out of NASA in Pasadena, California, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter is examining several features on Mars that address the role of water at different times in Martian history. Features examined the orbiter's advanced with its advanced instruments include deposits in gullies over the past 8 years, polar ice layers formed in recent geological past, and signs of water released by large impacts. So they're looking for gushing. They're looking for rivers or maybe landslides or gushes of water, perhaps from the impact and melting. We know that the water on Mars is still there. Fortunately, it's mostly in ice and rust. And yes, believe it or not, rust contains, you know, that was the byproduct of the water mixing with the iron. So you look at Mars, you see it's very red, and even in the night sky, you can tell it has a ruddy glow that comes from the rust on the surface of Mars. So last year, they discovered some fresh gully deposits by looking at before and after images from the Mars Global Surveyor, another spaceship. Mars is littered, well, not really, but it seems littered with spying eyes, probing eyes with the spacecraft we have. But it raised hopes that flows of liquid water had been detected on Mars. Observations made by the newer orbiter, the reconnaissance orbiter, suggests that they might have resulted from landslides of loose, dry material. So they were reporting on this the other day. Key question raised by these two deposits is whether water is coming to the surface of Mars today, and the evidence suggests that new deposits did not necessarily involve water. So kind of like with our search for UFOs or alien life, it's like we keep looking, we get bits of evidence, we get excited, but nothing definitive that Mars used to maybe have oceans and rivers and lakes, and maybe things swimming in those oceans and rivers and lakes. Still no signs of life on Mars, which is a little disappointing, but I guess a little reassuring as well, because I suppose if we thought about it, if Mars had started on life, or I'm sorry, if life had started on Mars and sort of went extinct, then, we're right next door, and the possibilities exist for us as well.
And let's not forget the possibility that Mars did have some sort of life forms, and then an asteroid hit or whatever, it brought some residue.
Oh, not the asteroids. Oh, Jay, I hardly sleep at night thinking of the asteroids.
Yeah, the transplantation of life,
right?
Viruses, whatever, from one planet or one solar system to the other.
Exactly.
There does seem to be some organic materials in certain meteorites that have rained down in the past.
Definitely. And as long as you brought that up, and since we're kind of jumping all over the map right here, I must bring up the fact that over at the Henry Ford Community College Planetarium, we are showing episodes of the famous and infamous, well, infamous just because it's made fun of a lot, but the Cosmos episodes from 1980, Carl Sagan, my hero, Carl Sagan explaining about biology and chemistry and physics and geology and astronomy, of course, and tying them all together in his incredibly wonderful 13-part series called Cosmos. Here at the planetarium, we are showing these episodes. Get down your pencil, folks, or get up your pencil and write it down. 11:15 on Fridays we start. The planetarium is open to the public, and it's also, apparently, going to be extra credit for students of astronomy here at Henry Ford Community College. We have an excellent science department here, as well as other things. It's an excellent college, an excellent place to come to learn, and the planetarium is open to you. The episodes are about an hour long, and if you don't know about Mr. Sagan, he is now deceased. Unfortunately, he died of cancer. But back in 1980, I know that's before some of our times, but I was a young, impressionable person at that time, and nobody had really come along and made science cool before. Now, I wouldn't go so far as to say that Carl Sagan was cool. He was definitely nerdy. He definitely had a very distinct way of talking. However, incredibly intelligent and incredibly good speaker and able to tie things together. And at that time, taking these new images from the Voyager spacecraft and the probes that we were just beginning to send out into space. Remember, this is 1980. There was no Hubble Space Telescope yet. And taking that information and synthesizing it for the average person and making it interesting and fascinating, actually, and bringing all the different sciences together. So I highly recommend that if you are free on a Friday morning, or if you have the ability to get some of the, they're on DVD with updated visuals, very high quality production, some updates by his wife, widow now, Andrian, and as well as some updates by himself 10 years after. Because remember, back in 1980, politics and science were a lot different than they are today. It was back in the Reagan era, and there was still a Cold War going on. And oftentimes he will sort of get a little bit dark, talking about the fate of the human race and nuclear holocaust. He didn't actually go too much into asteroid holocaust, but that's becoming more and more common today of thinking about. But it was a different time, but still incredibly optimistic in some ways. So, again, I'd just like to remind folks that you have excellent facilities here, and we do have planetarium shows open to the public on Tuesday nights at 7:30. This particular season of fall, The Road Not Taken is the name of the planetarium show hosted by our very own WHFR's general manager, Susan McGraw. Excellent production. So I'd like to invite you all to that. Jay, did you have something to say? Or?
Oh, just a plug for college teachers, and that is that Carl Sagan was a professor at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. And in fact, unfortunately, because he was one of the first so-called popularizers of information that college professors knew, but it wasn't getting out to the public. And Johnny Carson and The Tonight Show gave him a lot of a platform that allowed him to get involved more with television, like the groundbreaking, epic-making Cosmos series. My favorite recollection is the Cosmos series is so positive, it's so meaningful, in that it gives us a larger, grander purpose for the whole universe.
I agree.
Than just our mundane everyday life, which is part of the grand plan, maybe, but we should get beyond the petty battles and boundaries
One of his famous shots in the series, and he brings it up several times, is that cosmic calendar, the whole history of the universe laid out in this illuminated calendar on the ground, and you see all the months of the year, and then you wonder, where does human history fit into that giant calendar? You go down to the very last few seconds of December, 31st or December 30th, and that's where we are, very, very tiny bit of the entire history of the universe, and it puts things in perspective. And I remember watching that in high school, actually, and feeling very, very small going back to high school after I'd seen the episodes, and trying to hold on to the grass because I thought I'd fall into I had one of those moments of where your paradigm kind of shifts, of like everything you believed. I'm not the center of the universe. All these years I thought I was, and no, you're really not. You're just kind of a little flake of dust, but a very important flake of dust sitting here on planet Earth, which is a very tiny part of the big picture. However, it gives you kind of a sense of empowerment as well. Like, wow, look at us. Look what we've done. And look how much more there is to do. Okay, Jay. Well, I'd actually like to move on and talk about visiting planets, et cetera. And if you would do for me the clip number 6, let's talk a little bit about the other planets and visiting them.
It's nearly autumn. It's the time of year when scenery changes fairly quickly around us. Landscapes are mellowing and aging, turning different colors. Even the very stars in the sky are changing. Not only is the outdoor world changing, but things are changing inside as well. Your local museums and planetaria have new programs to offer. We're beginning to notice the shortening length of day. The sun is sluggish rising, and before you know it, it's fading off to the west to set. The summer triangle is still high overhead after sunset, but the constellations of autumn are seen at prime time, between 9 and midnight. These are the constellations of Andromeda, Perseus, and Pegasus. Pegasus flies high across the southern sky, upside down and head first, as always. Look for 4 stars high in the south in a great square shape, and you've most likely found Pegasus. The upper left-hand star is a star called Alpheres. Sometimes the star is also called Sura. The original Arabic name was Al-Sura Al-Faras, meaning the navel of the horse. The part that remains is the horse, or Alpheres. We all know it's his belly button, Sura. It's just funnier to remember it that way. Andromeda looks like 2 long, graceful antennae coming out of the belly button, which is an odd image, being that she's a princess. In fact, if I were to verbally describe the constellations of fall to you, it would end up sounding quite strange. Perseus reminds me of a witch's hat, and Cassiopeia the queen looks like the letter W with a floppy leg on one end. Not a very graceful image for one of her stature. The king Cepheus is even worse. He looks like a miniature house ready to topple over. The best way to learn the constellations is to visit your local planetariums.
There you can not only learn about the stars, but also see pictures and hear stories that connect meaning to the star pictures. Plus, you can meet other people who are interested in the world around them. And that's always a good adventure. Here at the Henry Ford Community College, the planetarium is open to the public. Tuesday nights features our star show open to the public at 7:30 p.m. Any other time, you can call the college, or you can call Carrie Zaitz at 810-845-7351 to book a show. As long as you have about 10 people or so, we'd be happy to have your group of scouts, or a birthday party, or maybe it's your local group of women that get together once a week. Doesn't really matter who you are, as long as you have an interest in the sky. Cranbrook and the Detroit Science Center have excellent facilities, and you'll always have fun there. So if you feel like looking at the sky, either outside or inside, visit your local museum or planetarium for your latest star show and adventure.
And yes, I guess I plugged it again, Jay. I forgot about that. But I would like to remind you that you are listening to WHFR, the Forum Show, on Saturday mornings from 10 to 11. Every Saturday, we have different topics. And this is the science show this morning. I'm very pleased to be here. My name is Carrie Zaitz, and I do planetarium shows here at the Henry Ford Community College Planetarium, as well as teach here and do other things as well. We are WHFR.FM. We're the station making waves, and not just sound waves, but light waves and brain waves as well this morning. Hopefully, maybe get you thinking about some things having to do with the sky. I remember in third grade asking my third grade teacher, why is the sky blue, Mr. Britt? I shouldn't say his name, but I don't know if he's still around. He's back in Rochester, New York. And, of course, Mr. Britt said, well, Carrie, the sky is blue because the ocean is blue. And then I said, Mr. Britt, well, why is the ocean blue? And I believe he said, if my memory serves me correctly, he said, because the sky is blue. So, of course, I was left wondering where the blue came from. But now I know. Some 30 years later, I figured out where the blue comes from. It's from the light from the sun getting scattered through the sky, actually. It's called Rayleigh scattering, if you really want to know the technical term. But the little air particles scatter light and preferentially scatter blue light best. And that's why we have a lovely blue sky. And luckily, human beings love blue. We have adapted to the blue sky very well. We see very well in it. Sometimes we think, well, maybe if we went to Mars, the sky would be different. But actually, pictures show that Mars has a fairly blue sky as well, sometimes kind of rusty red through the dust storms. But Venus, however, not a sky that we could actually look up into. I don't know if you knew this, Jay, but if you landed a spaceship on Venus, you would not have time to look up. You'd be crushed instantly by the intense atmosphere.
Ouch.
You would be melted by the intense temperatures, some 900 degrees, and maybe even eaten away by the acid rain falling from the skies in Venus. So we're pretty lucky to have a place here on Earth, a habitable planet. You look like you wanted to interject something there about the skies on Earth. Did you have a similar experience?
Just a tip for parents listening out there. Don't hold back science information from your kids. If you don't know something about why the sky is blue, kids can really learn very fast and can understand, too, faster than what, teachers maybe a couple decades ago would give them credit for. And if you don't know, folks, you can look it up, too, on the Internet. It's amazing
nowadays.
All the different search tools. I've just been using ask.com a little more than Google because there are, whenever you type something in, they give you suggestions. Well, would you rather maybe use this phrase and see what comes up? And so things like, why is the sky blue, could be typed into, for example, ask.com, and you could get rather specific responses much more quickly than otherwise. So don't hold back,
Jay,
the kids from science.
Yeah, unfortunately, sometimes you'll get answers that are a little bit hard to understand. I mean, the reason why the sky is blue, it's not a simple answer. Oftentimes, we're looking for the one-liners. And to be honest with you, it's not always a one-liner. It's a little bit complicated. And sometimes oversimplification introduces some errors in our thinking. However, it's better to check because kids –
are very good at detecting when you're not really talking and know what you're talking about. They're really good at detecting. I was going to say the sort of BS detector, if I may say that on the radio. But they can tell when you're kind of covering things up. So, but of course, it's always a good idea to give it a shot, you know. And sometimes the kids can teach us things. As a teacher, that happens all the time. But that gets me into another topic I actually wanted to touch on today, and that is science itself. What is science? And oftentimes we see things on TV and read things in the paper, and we don't know exactly where the information is coming from or what to believe, or it sounds crazy, and how could this be? It's hard to understand. So I actually have another little clip. Something I wrote before I felt very passionate about, which is it's called Seeing is Believing. And let's play the clip and maybe I can talk about it in a little bit.
Often we are torn between wanting to believe in something and knowing that things may not be just as we wish. I have been accused of being a scientist. Normally I'd be flattered, but when it's said with a little grimace and a funny tone of voice, I figure it's akin to a curse. I grew up believing in lots of things, from Santa Claus to Prince Charming. I believed in heaven and hell, and I learned the doctrines and dogma that would help me get to one place or the other. But when I realized that there were all sorts of good people who were never exposed to these doctrines, and therefore were doomed, I began to reject certain beliefs. Soon everything was under my skeptical scrutiny. The more I learned about the universe at large, and more importantly, the universe that each person perceives uniquely, the more I realized that the human brain is so complex and capable of such a gamut of perceptions that we really don't need to go outside ourselves to find ghosts and myths and gods and devils. However, we prefer to have them externally located, present company included, so we keep looking for demons and angels out in the universe. I listen with envy when people tell me about their fantastic experiences. I always try to relate, and my mind is always trying to understand and make sense of clues in the stories. I know I take a skeptical approach, but I don't think that's a bad thing. I listen to the stories, but I don't always buy them. I buy that the teller does, however, and it is never my intention to change anyone's belief. I am guilty of trying to interject some skepticism into their thinking. Thus I get labeled scientist. If they only knew, a substantial part of my interest in their ghost stories is wonder. I wonder why no dead relative has made a nocturnal visit. Why haven't any aliens abducted me? Am I so boring that no one wants to haunt me or capture my DNA for some future planet's repopulation? I want to believe. If some big-eyed alien crooked his three fingers at me and gestured me to go aboard a ship, I'd be up the ramp in a New York minute. I want to talk with dead people and see who I was in a past life. But I'm a scientist, and I'm not open to these possibilities, apparently. As my crop circle-loving husband reminds me, it's the open-minded scientists that make the big breakthroughs. However, Kepler had to divest from his superstitious thinking to figure out that the planets don't circle the sun, they travel in ellipses. Galileo, Newton, and even Einstein all had to distance themselves from dogmatic beliefs to look at the evidence. The key word for me is evidence. Without that, it's not science. And while evidence can sometimes be subjective, scientific evidence is the best hope we have of ferreting out the mechanics of the universe. Cars don't run on witchcraft. Having an open mind is not a bad thing. Neither is checking with Snopes.com to see if the latest chain email is a hoax. If something can be explained without resorting to aliens and ghosts, then why blame it on a ghost? I'm asking ghosts, and I'm free for a haunting tonight.
You know, I think I'm rethinking my free for a haunting tonight. I'm not sure if I actually want to be haunted after all. But I would like to be visited by an alien as long as they stick, or, you know, kind of have a hands-off approach. Well, you know, the stories. Stories get kind of graphic.
Abductions are not fun stories. No.
Very traumatic, apparently.
Very few people that have the stories about being taken for a ride mm-hmm. by alien race and,
yeah.
and having fun. No, they're not.
No. So. And that brings me to a point that something that I read the other day, you know, when you think about it, who are the the species that on any particular planet, who are the ones that are going to be traveling in space? Who are going to be at the top of the food chain? Well, here we are, supposedly top of the food chain. We are the ones who came up, you know, with space travel. And that would probably be true on another planet as well if they did get to that point, and they would be the predators of the planet, right? So maybe with some nefarious goals in mind, traveling to other planets. So I'm kind of, you know, my personal thoughts are that maybe we haven't been visited yet, and I'm kind of glad about that because I have a feeling that if we were, it might not be a pleasant experience for us.
I don't think we're going to be like,
we come in peace with a handshake.
Well, if you just don't know, I think movies and TV shows always, they want to get us into the story and get their characters into certain predicaments that somehow they can get out of, they don't use good judgment. I mean, they just rush right in. You know,
on the other hand, if we go from like the Star Trek episodes, you know, sometimes the more evolved beings are actually kinder and gentler and have gotten rid of their corpus, the body, and just gone into mind and they're sort of like Buddhist monks floating in space. So we could hope that we're visited by those kind of aliens that just kind of
take pity on us.
yes, and perhaps help us along in our journey.
Yeah, they don't want to exploit or eat us. They just take pity on us.
And with a swipe of their hand, they can get rid of all those asteroids heading our way. But again, it's fun to think about. I know that here in Dearborn, we are very much looking forward to our guest this evening. If you're listening to, on a Sunday when the replay is, it'll be passed. However, we are looking forward to our visitor, Stanton Friedman, who's going to be talking about UFOs and the evidence he has found as a nuclear physicist for UFO visitation, not just UFOs, but visitation and crashes, etc. So if you're interested in that, you should come tonight. Jay, maybe you could fill in a few details about that.
Looking right at the flyer
yes,
here.
Yes, that's what I was thinking.
UFO researcher and nuclear physicist Stanton T. Friedman, an illustrated lecture. That means he's in person. And he's got slides, and they're real high quality. It's not that video stuff where you get low res. And his presentation is tonight, Saturday, September 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at the Conference Center right here at Henry Ford Community College main campus. Some people were calling today and didn't know we had a conference center. Mm. Yeah, folks, it's just immediately south. Just a little further south, just the next building over from the Student Center, which is right on Evergreen Road just south of Ford Road. And it has been renamed after our former president, who was here for many, many years, Dr. Andrew Mazzara. So it's the Mazzara Conference Center. Free parking all around there. Does start at 7:30. We sold about half the tickets already. Half of each ticket is sold. Half of the total number of tickets are sold, and we expect a lot of people showing up. So the doors open at 7 o'clock, and if you'd like to see Stanton Friedman, his presentation is going to be, he said, about an hour and a half, and then he'll be taking questions and answers, and he does have his books, and we'll do autographs afterwards.
Of course he will. Thank you, Jay. I appreciate that. Forgive me cutting you off, but he's taken enough of my time for today. I had a very interesting conversation with him yesterday as well, too, and that was really actually quite pleasant, just discussing things with him, my point of view and his point of view. And it comes down to evidence and science and maybe our different definitions of what evidence consists of and maybe the scientific process. Because obviously evidence can be open to interpretation. I suppose ultimately it's not supposed to be. Ultimately there should be some sort of truth behind everything. However, that's often impossible to reach with our present knowledge. So we all do the best we can, take the information and experiences we have and synthesize it into our worldview, if I may use that term, and try to go with that. So yes, there's lots and lots of people out there who have had experiences that they can't explain. They've seen things that they can't explain. For me to jump right into an explanation that is kind of perhaps not the easiest one to swallow for me, it's something that I choose not to do. I know that people say there's lots of evidence of it out there, but realistically speaking, many, many, many eyewitness reports, et cetera, it's not considered hard scientific evidence. We need something that we could study and test. It's got to be testable. So testing the human mind, well, we try to do it, but it's not the most reliable piece of evidence that we could have. So anyway, I'm sure Mr. Friedman has different thoughts of that and has maybe some different evidence to provide us. So we'll be looking forward to that. Speaking of evidence, I wanted to kind of touch on something else that
that relates to sort of a, I wouldn't call it a fringe science, but something that people are interested in and perhaps not maybe in the realm of science, and that's astrology. I just wanted to say that, I am one person who actually does read a horoscope from time to time just to see. And I think it's kind of related to what connects all human beings is our desire to try to understand ourselves and understand what's going on in our lives. So in that realm, I kind of look at the astrology to see what people are thinking and what, you know, what connections they're trying to make. The astrologer is obviously trying to please the readers so that the readers will read the astrology columns and give them money, perhaps. But it also kind of gives you a sense of where people's heads are at. So, as a scientist, as an educator, I'm always interested where what people are thinking and how they're thinking, because I often have to go and try to, you know, build on information that may or may not be scientifically sound. So I need to know what I'm working for or against. So, and that brings me back to the whole thing I was trying to say in that little clip, which is, try to get information that you think is reputable or that is known as reputable and try to make your decisions from that. And we had talked about this before, Jay, about getting information from as many sources as you can. So I'd just like to put in another plug for that, because in these days, it's so easy to get misinformation or to not get any information and form your opinions from very little information. So another plug for that.
So tell us, Carrie, very quickly, even though you're a scientist and you're a college teacher and so on, as well as a teacher of many other levels, too, you have experience throughout the whole spectrum, but where do you get your science information primarily from, even though it may not be typical for most people? You're on the Internet a lot, I know.
I am on the Internet.
Any magazines or newspapers?
Well, NASA, the NASA sites. Unfortunately, okay. NASA doesn't always keep up with the latest, but oftentimes you can find ancillary sites that have taken the NASA information and made it into a little bit more digestible information. But as far as the space programs, there's actually I was looking at one this morning called, it's on my headline here somewhere. It's space travel, about space travel, exploration, and tourism, which is pretty interesting because perhaps there's some, financial gain expected behind some of this stuff. But again, this came from NASA. This was the article I mentioned about the Troy connection. So doing Google searches for space news, et cetera, you'll generally end up with some JPL information, some NASA information. I also very much appreciate, Jay, you letting me read your Discover magazines, your Skeptic magazines, as well as I actually am at home. I get Science News, which is a very small digestible periodical that I get every week. It's a weekly magazine that comes to my home.
Yes, that's excellent. I used to subscribe to that, too.
And it's all the sciences, yeah. And for me, that's good because I tend to be a little physics astronomy heavy, but I really appreciate the articles on biological advances and chemistry and et cetera. And they're all usually related, as you know, and I've preached this before, the sciences are all kind of related. So it's really, and it gives it to me. I can read it over my dinner or something.
Yeah, folks, you won't get this on television. Yep. Okay, this kind of information about science, the latest, most exciting stuff that's happening that tells us about the universe and the planet that we're on. So Science News, if you can find that, even in public libraries, Discover Magazine, and many, many more.
Yeah. But if you want to talk to human beings, I would suggest that, again, you come to Henry Ford Community College or visit another planetarium. There's always somebody there incredibly enthusiastic and passionate about teaching about science. And we are the ones. We're supposed to be the communicators. That's how I see myself, as somebody who takes this information and tries to present it in an entertaining, exciting way. And that's what I do in my teaching. That's what I do in my planetarium show. So if you do have interest in science, come visit us. Come to a show. Come ask. I have people asking me all the time, the questions that they've been harboring, like, why is the sky blue? My third grade teacher, et cetera. I had to ask somebody, Luckily, my dad was a physics teacher, so he could help me out. But not everybody has a physics teacher dad. So I love to get questions. I love to get emails. If you see my column in the paper, please email me. I would love to talk with you about science. I just love it. I love science. I don't know if you noticed, but it's one of my things. So I know we're kind of wrapping the show down a little bit now, and I've really enjoyed talking about various topics with you.
I was going to play you one last clip, but I think that perhaps I'd just like to mention that the constellations that you'll see this time of year are the fall constellations. You will see a little bit of the summer triangle right after sunset. But if you're wondering what it is up there you're seeing, I'd like to let you know. Those three bright stars in the shape of a triangle, they're called the summer triangle. Each has its own constellation. But you will see, once more, you'll see Jupiter in the southwest horizon, very bright. It doesn't appear to twinkle very much. The moon will be out. It'll be a waxing gibbous moon up until the full moon. Remember the date for the full moon, Jay? The 27th, I said? Did I say? Or the 26th? I'm sorry, it's the 26th, the harvest moon. That will
I
be
have it on my day planner.
Oh, do you? Okay.
It comes printed that way.
I'd also like to remind you of the 10:15, or I'm sorry, the 11:15 Friday showing of Cosmos over in the planetarium. And also like to remind you that all my opinions that I've expressed today are mine alone and not of the stations or not of the Henry Ford Community College. Hopefully I'm not the only one that shares these opinions, but hopefully I haven't offended anyone with my opinions. I don't think so. Mostly just based on science and my understanding of it. We are WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves, and we make waves in all different ways. Today has been a lovely time with you, Jay, here talking about science and things in the sky. And I see we're getting ready for the next show. So I think I'd like to wish you all a lovely weekend. Hopefully we'll see you at the Stanton Friedman Lecture tonight, if it's Saturday for you. And let's talk about more things next week, Jay, at the Journal Show, 10 o'clock on Fridays. I'd like to wish you all a ticket to the moon in this song. Bye-bye.
I've got a ticket to the moon. I'll be leaving here any day soon. Yeah, I've got a ticket to the moon, but I'd rather see the sunrise in your eyes. Got a ticket to the moon. I'll be rising high above the earth so soon, and the tears I cry might turn into the rain that gently falls upon your window. You'll never know. Thank you.